Welcome back to the Wolf of Queen Street podcast. Today on the show, Corinne Horan, a breast cancer survivor twice, author of the book, I'm More Than Just My Tits, an amazing name. You do breast cancer foundation rehab through your Paddle for Hope initiatives and so much more. Also proudly a mother of three, and you're going out there at the moment in the world. We've also spent about a year trying to get each other on the show and talking about trying to come out with a voice, a public voice about helping other people, about doing the right things in the community, and also talking about her female empowerment. And as your book says, I'm More Than Just My Tits, showing that you can live your life after cancer and what it means and how to get through it. And Corinne, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And it has been a long time waiting. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't say waiting. I didn't make you wait.
Yeah. No,
shit just didn't line up.
It just didn't. Yeah. We were busy.
That's the lives.
Yes.
Yeah. It does happen like that. I've had people on the show before that I've taken 2 years to get on the show, but that was more in the sense of me like stalking them for 2 years before they finally said yes. A gentleman called Michael Lane that owned Success Resource in Australia, that took 2 years for me to finally get it, and then he finally said, okay, I'll give you the one opportunity.
Ooh.
But there was a bigger story to that, but anyway. So, Corinne, talk me through, obviously, you know, you've gone through breast cancer twice. It's not something that people would ever want to go through, even the first once and all the rest of it. And I know, I think your first one was at the age of 26,
yep.
You know, a very young in that space. Talk me through how that was and your experience around that.
Well, 26, 1999, not a lot of information online. You hardly meet people who have had breast cancer at this age. I found a couple of researchers. I was in shock of my life, and it happened very close to the time where my mom passed away. Mm-hmm. So my mom passed away at 50 from a heart attack, and about a year later I was diagnosed, and it was such a shock to the system. But I guess that something that I feel comfortable talking about is that I managed to very quickly just be super practical. And I don't think I dwelled on it much. I just went, okay, what do we need to do?
Yeah.
And when I look back at my first breast cancer diagnosis, my second breast cancer diagnosis, both of them very traumatic experiences in my life, practicality and just to let's do it. It's like Nike, like do it is my second name. I just went straight into treatment. I went straight into a couple of surgeries, and I had to gather people around me. And I remember that day when I rang a very good friend of mine and I said, I've got cancer. And he immediately called his dad because his dad was a doctor as well. And so I started ringing everybody. And I guess this is me. I just gather people around me. I gather people around my family. I am a people's person. I knew I didn't steal it from anyone. I wanted to be loved. I wanted people to help me. And I wanted to share my story from day one. And I think that this is what got me through the journey. Now you're 26, so young. I graduated my bachelor degree in communication and political science. I wanted to work. I wanted to party. I wanted to get married, you know, have kids. I had to freeze my eggs. I had to think about so many different components at that time while you're on a fight or flight.
Yeah.
You're on survival mode. And I think when you surround yourself with the right people as well that can hold your hand, and that's what happened to me. It was my sister, it was my dad, it was my really good friends. I could go through that wave. I had someone else that was also responsible on writing notes or taking me to the hospital. I could breathe through. And I guess it for me, it is a pattern. It is my habit. It is engraved in me to just be practical. So it was writing everything down, making sure I've got the right list and my temperature and everything. And I research and I ask questions and I just kept on living life. It was hell. It was hard. Back then, medication was harsh. All the treatments and the protocols were not really tailored. They were, okay, this is what you're going to have. Mm. And every 2 weeks to drive the hospital was really, really difficult. There were a lot of tears. There was a lot of exhaustion. But I really wanted to get to the end of it as quickly as I could. And I remember one day where my chemo was postponed because of my low blood white cells count. And I was in tears in the hospital. I said, I just want it to end. I just want to finish this. You know, it was a year of my life. And having a partial mastectomy as a 26-year-old was huge, but I'm lucky. Mm-hmm. And I always say I'm one of the lucky ones. So being 26 was shocking, but I think that actually being 40 with three children with a reoccurrence was even a bigger traumatic moment for me, for sure.
It's amazing to see how you push through it, Nat. And I've got a couple of pointers on, because I can imagine if my wife watches this, she would have wished I was the same when I had my brain tumor 5 years ago, because I went the opposite way. I went quiet. I didn't say anything. I went down, you know, rabbit hole, and there was none of that. And it took still a good few years, and still until this day, of me working through a lot of what that was when I should have. Because from my diagnosis to brain surgery was 3 months. So there was a lot of, it'll be okay. Not just waiting. It was like never, it was like, okay, it happened, and you get told by a doctor that you might not be alive tomorrow, and you slightly process that, but then you don't really. And then you're just like, okay, leave it. And then, like she always said, you know, let's talk about it. And I was like, no, I'm fine. But it was because, again, being male, and not been shown their way. It was just, okay, I'm just going to swallow it, and then I'll sort it out later. I was watching a video the other day, and there was a scene in it, and the guy, I know it was in a movie, but it was so true. And it was something happened to the guy, and the guy was getting emotional, and his friend said, swallow it, put it away for now, and we can talk about it later. And it was so true, in the sense of, in the guy's nature, is like, just take that in, hold it, and we might discuss it at a later stage. I can imagine she would have really loved me to be on your thought pattern, right?
But you can't be hard on yourself at the same time, because I think that, you know, I always respect, and when people ask me a lot in public talks, you know, how can I help someone who's going through this? And I always say, first of all, respect the way they want to handle it. Slowly, slowly, carefully, you can kind of try to push them here and move them there. But it is so important to understand who you are. And as I said to you in the beginning, you know, when I started answering the question, this is who I am. I found who I am even more through these adversities. Mm-hmm. Like it's. Someone asked me, were you always like out there and talking to a million people and being out there on social? And I said, no, actually, I was a shy girl.
Yeah,
I was, you know, quite withdrawn. And so when you were talking about it, this is you. But I think that people are willing to help you more, I believe, when you are more open 100%. To receiving, because it's a chain reaction, right? Snowball. It's receiving, giving, giving, receiving. Mm-hmm. So when you're open to people, they feel comfortable.
Yeah.
You know,
so totally true.
Yeah.
One question I just want to ask about your first diagnosis is, just for any of the audience that's interested, is how was it picked up? If you're happy to disclose, was that just did you just go have a mammogram and was picked up, or is there something that was feeling wrong?
So with my first diagnosis, I was 26, as we said before, and I would never think, like, it never occurred to me that a little lump, which I felt, and I could actually even notice a little bit because it was quite on the top right breast. So it started to push. So that meant that my immune system was actually reacting to it. So it becomes like a little cyst. And I started feeling something suspicious, but I thought to myself, well, 26, like what can happen, right? But then I was babysitting. I was babysitting for a friend, and I told her about it. And she said that's not right. It's older than me, you know. I wouldn't even, like, looking back, didn't occur to me. And so she said, you've got to go and check it out. You've got to go and check it out. It started actually becoming quite painful, like sensitive to touch. And so I went straight to a GP and he didn't like what he saw and what he felt. And he sent me immediately to the next room. I was lucky. It was in a clinic that had a mammogram and ultrasound. And they picked it up in the ultrasound. And I remember the face of that lady that was working there at that time. And she looked at me, she said, you've got to go back. You've got to go back straight to the GP. And then we had another consultation. That's when my sister and my brother, my father came along, held my hand. And I was told, you've got breast cancer, but you're going to be okay. And I think that when I relate to what you said earlier, it's like, I wasn't given a time limit. I wasn't given any assumption of how long or what's going to happen. And I think that doctor that day, when he held my hand as well, and I had one tear, I remember I had one tear. I was like, okay, what are we doing? It was a sense of I guess, confidence that it's going to be okay. And all I need to do is find the way to get there.
It is, it's getting the right information with the right stuff. You know, with yours, with your doctor saying it's going to be okay. With mine, there wasn't that. There wasn't, okay,
and
you're going to
be
okay.
Right?
And that was the big part of the difference. And the reason why it wasn't there was, hey, yes, we can do it. But where it was, I was, if anything drastic happened, you know, I wouldn't be okay. And that was, I think, the lot of the biggest pieces was I was working of how close it was and all the rest of it. And then finding out from the specialist, I could have, my growth could have been there for up to 10 years. And it's just been getting worse and worse and not realizing it. And
it's our brain. Like, we're talking tits. You're talking brain. Like, my tits are not my brain. You know, so, if I lose my tits, I'm very open about it. Like, what's the worst case scenario? You know, so brain is scary. I know a young girl now battling brain tumor. It's really scary, especially when, you know, you don't know the stage that it was actually detected. And I think this is something that a lot of people really need to understand, is that the result or how you're going to be treated or what's the, you know, statistics of you actually surviving something is how early you detect it.
100%.
And the biggest problem I can see even in New Zealand is early detection. And it's not just coming from the medical staff or from the institutions. It's actually coming from people not wanting to check out their bodies and their suspicious, you know, areas that you go, oh, something's changed. And I have spoken to so many women along the years who actually refused to check themselves, thought they're going to be fine. Culture, you know, was a barrier. We've got culture barriers here. We've got, you know, we're an immigration country.
Correct.
And so you're coming with all sorts of beliefs about what is your body meant to do? And do I check it? Do I have the right sometimes to even touch anything or remove parts of my body in order to treat myself? So there's a taboo around some cultures as well that you've got to break in order to give them the opportunity to survive something like this.
It is so true. And you're so accurate about the willingness to go. Like, my willingness to go and just get it checked up because of the way I was feeling, which was the trigger, there was something not right. That was months, so I started picking up the end part of 2019, the last couple of months going into December and into January, that things weren't right. But end part of 2018 going into 2019. And the 2018 originally was the best year I ever had in my life. I was traveling the world and I was doing all these things, and I was this cocky, arrogant person before the universe humbled me. And This way I started the show because I wanted to be Jordan Belfort. I wanted to be rich and famous, and I thought Jordan Belfort was a good role model.
No, so you know that his second wife is a friend of mine.
Is it?
Yeah.
So this is, and it's funny. So this is why
the
it's called
real the one.
The
real,
that's why it's called the Wolf of Queen Street, because I wanted to be the Wolf of Wall Street. And I looked at him and said, hey, he's the right person. And this is how my how I thought was important in the world before I had my situation. I realized what was.
Interesting.
And then, and then for months, I just thought it was like a hangover of having two of a good year, traveling too much, partying too much. And it would have taken at least 3 months before I finally went and saw my GP. Now, in the length of the period of what I had my condition, it wasn't that drastic. I think it was good for years. But where I was, there was no guarantee of a day, a week, or month later of I was so close to you've got to get something sorted.
Because denial is the worst. And a lot of people get into a denial mode or a freezing mode.
Correct.
And they just want to tack it away because things are happening in their lives. And both of my cancer diagnoses, I've asked one question.
Mm-hmm.
Not why me, why now?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't come at the right time and it never does.
Mm-hmm.
It never does. And you've got to deal with it because it's always when something's great happening or you've suddenly wanted to change something in your life and you're going through a change and this is a signal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a signal. Yeah.
Yeah, it totally is. And we've just got to, you know, so I push a lot of my guy friends and the same as you would be on your friends of, hey, not feeling well, have you got a check, you know. So a lot of my mates, I'm just about to hit 40 this year. And so my friends are between 40 and sort of up into the mid 50s, late 50s and stuff. And we're in that culture, right? We're in that generation of, it's fine, I'll be okay. And it's like, no, fuck you. I can tell you're not going to be okay because I've gone through it. And I was the young one. In my circle, I'm the young one in the wider circle that I have. And at that stage, I was, you know, I was 35, I was fit, I was traveling the world, you know, I was 20 odd kgs lighter than I am now. I looked healthy, but I wasn't really. And all the rest of it. And that's what I'm saying. If that's what I look like and that still happens, don't come give me your shit and go, no, I'll be fine.
Yeah, because people rely on, I guess, modern medicine and they go, oh, she'll be all right, you know, or he'll be all right. And that attitude as well, I think relying on this modern medicine that everything is fixable, you know, it's fixable. And I even when I kind of finished my chemo and radiotherapy and all the treatments, most of my surgeries, you know, people went, oh, you're okay now, right? You're okay now. And it's like, no, now I'm so much more vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
And trauma like you've had or I had brings, you know, a lot of things can trigger that again because it's trauma. It's all related to trauma. And so you've got to look after yourself. You've got to check yourself all the time because there's secondary cancer. People forget there's secondary breast cancer. Mm-hmm. I've seen it throughout the journey with Pedal On and the Pedal for Hope and speaking in public, people raising their hands, telling me their stories. And like, okay, it doesn't end there.
Yeah.
You've got to be vigilant and you've got to go and check yourself out if you find anything suspicious. You got to know your body.
Yeah. True.
You know?
100%.
Yeah.
Let's jump forward to second diagnosis, Rich, right?
Yeah.
How was, again, let's just talk for people so they can understand how did that get picked up?
Yep.
Talk me through that.
So second diagnosis came into the end of 2012, beginning 2013. Just doing Pedal for Hope. I remember postponing one of my tests.
Mm.
I was meant to go for a checkup and I said, no, I've got time for this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was already after I started Pedal for Hope, the fundraiser on the water, and I felt I was the healthiest person. You know, it was almost 13 years past the first diagnosis and the journey of my first breast cancer. And so I was monitored, and there were a few tiny little spots that were detected, but every time I went there to do a mammogram or an ultrasound, I said, no, it's all good, it looks okay. We're just gonna monitor. At some point I felt this real pulling sensation and I said, I know this feeling. This is not right. So I insisted on checking it out. And at the end, I remember getting a phone call from my GP saying, okay, we've decided to schedule a proper biopsy. And I said, oh, thank God for that. And then I did a biopsy, and I remember her calling me on that afternoon, 4:30 in the afternoon. My girls are around me, no one around. I'm about to make dinner. Little kids, you know, Pania was one, almost one. Little tiny girls. And the GP rang me, and she said, look, I've got to check your incision and everything and see that the stitches, like, I just want to check you out. I want to see how you're going. I'm like, I'm okay. Just spill it out. I said, no, no, no. I want you to come to the clinic. And I said, no, I'm not coming to clinic. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. Yeah. And she said, I'm really sorry, but you've got breast cancer and you actually have a few tumors. Like, it wasn't one, it wasn't two. First diagnosis was less than a centimeter. It was so tiny. I had about 10. So that meant that something got missed out on that monitoring time. And I know from one of the nurses who said, look in your files. When you finish your journey, please look in your files. And I think I'll find that they've missed out. They've misdiagnosed. They didn't go all the way with biopsy, and I should have done it a long time before that. And it came on in the other breast. So the first one was the right, then it came on the left. And it sounded like someone was speaking to me through a glass door, like, you've got breast cancer, you know, and you're like, it's like in the movies, like you whatever you were holding in your hand, you know, at the time, you know how in the movies it just drops? Yeah. It just felt like this. And I had to shut the door in my bedroom and just take a few breaths and ring the father of my kids. And that was a time when we were going through a lot and we separated a few times, got back together, separated. And I had to find him. I didn't know exactly where he was. So I rang his manager and I had to tell him that, it's back. And I remember the tears. I remember sitting on my bed and just the tears started falling. And he goes, what do you mean? What's back? And I said, my cancer's back. And that was it. That was the diagnosis. And I looked at my three daughters back then and I said, I've got to do this again, and I've got to do this for them. And in hindsight, you know, as hard as it was probably one of the most difficult times of my life to go through this on your own in New Zealand, no immediate family around, gather again, everybody, look at the children. In hindsight, they were my beacon. They were my why. I had to get up every day. I had to put on the makeup. I had to walk them to kindy and school. I had to make dinner. I had to find nannies. I had to gather all that community that I was lucky to have at that time already from the Pedal for Hope and, you know, people who knew me, who came in with all their power, honestly, and, you know, started a spreadsheet and we knew exactly what's happening. And I had a friend, Claire, who held my hand and took me to every appointment, and I had all my other friends. It was a really, really tough time in my life, but it hasn't ended then, because I had so many misfortunate scenarios with my breast reconstruction that I'm still going through it. So it's been, what, 11 years? And I can't say like a complete goodbye to the journey of breast cancer.
I don't think in anyone's story you can ever say goodbye to.
No, and when they go, all clear, I'm like, do you have the guarantee? Do you have the guarantee that it will never come back? And that's when I always struggle with all the insurance companies and everything. So, it's not terminal. I said, it's not terminal. Terminal, but you can't guarantee to me
done. I didn't get paid out.
Yeah, so I haven't gotten paid out.
No, so so I got covered for my surgery, but all my income and that was one of the big things why I stumbled. It was, I went from wanting to be the Jordan Belfort, right on top of the mountain, to almost being financially broke. And marriage falling apart. And because they told me I'm healthy. and they told me I got no long-term effects.
And it's not true. And that is why the whole rehabilitation and talking about the after, the aftershock, you know, it's like an earthquake. Earthquake happened, but what about the aftershock?
Yeah, and all the rest of it. And it was crazy because I'm no longer with the insurance company I use. I've got a company now that I'm fully protected. But about a year ago, there was a front page on the Stuff where a young couple had the exact same condition as me. She did. She went for the surgery and the exact thing happened to them and they had to bankrupt themselves.
Yeah.
Because and I literally emailed Stuff. It was never picked up, but I emailed Stuff and said, here's my story. It is identical. I went through the exact same thing. Lucky enough, we literally hit bottom and we were able to just come back from it. Because I'd been successful a bit in my life, so I had a little bit to bounce back on. This young couple didn't. And their lives were ruined after going through trauma and then financial ruin.
And people don't talk about the financial effect it has, because I remember when I was diagnosed the second time more than the first time, I was very much aware of, I was into fitness and health, and so I wanted to eat everything organic and I wanted to go alkaline and I wanted to go to yoga and meditate and do all that, and you lose your job or your opportunity to work full time. I mean, I've had a few people who I've met along the way say, no, I've just been diagnosed and I'm definitely going to continue everything I've been doing, and bang, you fall. And as much as you want to, it's just what it is. And so I feel like I've kind of lost a big part of my life battling this. I gained a lot as well, emotionally, with my, you know, everything that I've created out of adversity is wealth.
Yes.
Right? But money-wise, people don't talk about it. And you see fundraising pages over and over every day, fundraising. I'm going, what is going on with these institutions that put you on, you know, as a client, sign you up, and then there's a disclaimer.
Yeah.
And you didn't read the little letters down there in that document. Oh, you didn't know that, you know, yes, it's been 13 years, but it's a reoccurrence. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to protect. So you're not going to get your trauma. And I had a big hoo-ha with AMP back then. And they had, I think, a big kind of a lawsuit, I think, in Australia. There was a lot going on back then. I had a reporter calling me at some point, and I had a back and forth, and the advisor's not there anymore, and you've got no one to talk to follow. There's no proof for what they're saying because it's been years and years and years, and didn't get the payout for the trauma, and it could have really, really helped me, especially because I was on my own and really relied on myself and friends and a bit of help here and a bit of help here from family. But it's a massive toll. And then to rebuild yourself as well, and people suffer from fatigue. There's a lot going on after that cancer diagnosis and journey, you know?
True. When I go on stage and speak about my story, I say my surgery was the easiest part.
Yep.
Okay. I say the day of my surgery and getting that through, that was the easiest part of my journey.
Yes.
The 2 years post the surgery was the hardest part. Learning where I was, because with my brain surgery, they had to remove my pituitary gland, so I don't have any hormones. I'm a different person. Some days I'm manic depressive. Some days I'm bipolar. In the weird sense, some days, like there's days I can't get out of bed for 2 days. Wow. There's days I can't talk to my kids. So 5 years ago, my boy would have been 7. My daughter would have been 10. All they wanted to do is play and cuddle with dad. And there's days where like I was violently angry.
Yeah, anger is part of it. Yeah,
I had no control of it.
Yes.
So I wasn't angry because I was angry or what happened to me. I was angry because of the side effects. I've learned
medication,
that. I've learned that a lot now. So I can say I'm now in this situation where I can say to the wife, hey, I'm having a bad day. I'm either angry or I'm down. When I'm saying I'm down, then she knows, and I go to the bed. So the craziest point to me, the last time I had a down moment was, to any sports stars out there, was the Rugby World Cup final where South Africa was playing. On the Saturday, I had a down moment. I slept for 20 hours straight.
Wow.
I woke up only because of the final and we were hosting it. I got up, sat on the couch, watched the game. South Africa won, and I was just like, yay. And only like 3 days later, when I recovered from my down moment, was it like, holy shit, we just won the World Cup, right? So I missed that whole moment because of, but luckily I can understand it. A lot of other people don't.
Yeah.
And learn this from themselves. And this is where going out and speaking to people and explaining it, and then people going, shit.
Yeah, you're not alone, right? I understand that. Yeah.
And all the rest of it. And also gives you a better understanding of people that might have other conditions.
Yes.
So people that are bipolar or manic depressive, whichever term you use, I go through bouts like that. And you can have an understanding of that.
Yeah.
Because my body does trigger the same way. And it's just a whole learning from it.
Especially I think for men. You know, to admit that I'm having a bad day. And it's like women are my period, or I'm having a bad week, or I'm, you know, it's the time of the month, you know, you get to, my daughter, I'll go, okay, I'm staying away. Yeah. But when it comes to males, I think it's like being vulnerable.
Yeah, totally.
And admitting that something is a big deal. You know?
Yeah, I've spoken on stage and saying there's times where I feel like, and this is the closest I can put to people to understand it, is I have PMS like on a daily basis, right? I know I have no other way to understand it, but there's ways that stuff's not rational. I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm emotional. So if I take a look at what male's expectation of PMS is, I tick most of those boxes. Yes. It's not something that I'm proud about, but it's something that I can understand and go, and that's where I cycle up and down. And this was the joke of, I was learning all of this with recovering while I was fighting my insurance company. And they were like, you're healthy. I'm like, fuck, I am healthy, right?
Yeah. Don't you want me to be healthy?
Yeah.
But you still owe me money.
Yeah. So,
you know, I totally hear you and relate to you because the hormonal changes I've gone through, I was on tamoxifen, and another medication that helps level up the balance hormones and estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to reduce estrogen. If it's hormonal related cancer that is hormonal related, you've got to take medication for 6 years to 10 years. And I remember the first 6 months, it was horrible. And I remember messaging some of my old nannies. They were European. They came here, you know, old peers. And I said, I'm so sorry for the way I behaved at that time. I said it to my girlfriends lately. I still say it. I'm so sorry. Because as you mentioned, you just become a whole other person. And you don't want to act like a victim, but you are a victim. It's something that I've just recently learned, actually, from watching a lot of coaches that deal with trauma and therapists. I was talking to Nadine Macaluso that was married to the Wolf of Wall Street. She's a therapist. She deals with trauma and trauma bonding. And just acknowledging, it's okay to acknowledge that you were a victim to something.
Yeah.
So along the years, you kind of learn to develop skills, how to deal with that depressed moment, or how to deal with being too much up and down. So for me, it was meditation, journaling. You know, I went to yoga throughout my journey, and I haven't done yoga before. So I was like, okay, I'm going to start doing yoga. I'm going to try to help myself as much as I can, so I'll be a better person at home. But admitting it is very important, and getting the right people behind you and around you to say it is okay that you are like this right now, and being tolerant towards you and compassionate, because we are the worst enemies towards ourselves. We can be super compassionate to someone else and go, oh my God, this person's going through breast cancer. Yeah. I'm like, I can't even imagine. And you'll go like, well, you got to remember yourself, right? So very important. Yeah.
So true. So I'm going to ask you an interesting question, which I believe it happens more than people think. I don't know on your site. I do research, but I haven't seen this anywhere. But so the question is, was suicide ever on the table through your journey?
No, throughout my breast cancer journey?
Yep. So it wasn't mine.
No. I think I've realized how much I love life. And I think especially with the second diagnosis, seeing my children, knowing that I'm a solo mom, who's going to look after these kids? It's a true story. It's like I'm mostly on my own with them. I could not bear the thought. Mm-hmm. And when we have big arguments at home, sometimes I kind of spit it out and I go, do you know how much I fought for, you know, to be here, for God's sake? Do you know? And they'll go, okay, here we go. Here it's coming. And I go, it's not that I sacrifice myself for you. I am selfishly sacrificing myself to myself so you can also have someone there to look after you. It was like they were, I wrote their names on a mirror. I have a very big gold mirror in my bedroom. And I placed it back then. We lived in Milford. I placed it right in front of my bed. So when I got up or when I went to sleep, the mirror was in front of me, right? And I bought this white and pink chalk and I wrote their names. And then I wrote all sorts of quotes as well that I related to and gave me, and words like family and life. And I would change them, but the names of my children were always on that mirror. And yes, there were moments where I felt like I'm drowning and how the hell am I going to get out of this and when? But their photos were around me. So there were a lot of tools that actually, I guess, saved me from going there. But I would never judge you and I would never judge anyone for saying, I don't want to do this anymore. The only moment I remember when I had my DIP flap operation, that's an 8-hour procedure to reconstruct my right breast. They've taken a bit of skin and tissue from my lower abdomen to reconstruct my right breast. And I had a very big infection in my lower abdomen from the donor site. I got to hospital, to an emergency, to the emergency room. And that was the only time when I rang my sister back in Israel. I was in agony. It was like a flesh eating bug. It was just horrific. They didn't pick up on it. That was another story. Pick up on it. And so I ended up there 8 hours standing, 7 hours standing, leaning, crying at the emergency room. Haven't been seen. I rang my sister and I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I just want out of this. That was as close as I probably got to almost giving up. And I know that I didn't mean it this way of, you know, I want to die, because I didn't, but I couldn't handle that pain anymore. I couldn't handle the journey anymore of running in and out, going in and out of hospitals. That was as close as I got to, I can't do this anymore. And she asked me one question. She said, do you want me to get on a plane right now? She's my sister, is my half sister. She's a full sister. She's probably the most full sister you can get. And I'm very emotional when I speak about her because she's always been there for me. And in 72 hours, she was there. She came to New Zealand. She didn't know anyone. She didn't know New Zealand. And she came for my kids. And she looked after them together with a few friends. And I was still in the hospital. So that was as, this was so real. And that was a moment that was really significant in my journey.
That's amazing. It's powerful. And it's those sort of things as well that we need to, we that have gone through and experienced it, not only need to have had our own moments, but we've had moments with others, again, for to give us an understanding so that we can explain to other people how you're going to have your moments, but also you're going to have moments with others, and how important that is, and how it's not in, it's not just important for yourself. For example, it'd be important for your sister as well. And it's both ways. And it's just a long journey that that people need to realize as well.
I think it's you know, when we talk about cancer, when I speak in public, I always say, don't be selfish. Not to get checked. Don't be selfish not to do the right thing and help yourself, because you're not just affecting one person. It's affecting everyone around you. If you've got children, if you've got siblings, friends, colleagues, you know, you've got to remember that there are people around you that will be affected by this. And so you can't be selfish, and you've always got to be, I guess, kind, mm-hmm. good, and, you know, help the community and invest in community, because you never know when you'll need that help. So you're not doing it for it,
yeah,
but it definitely helps to get those people to come and reach out and help.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So one last thing I want to cover for today. Talk me through your cancer, your rehab and foundation. Talk me through the organizations that you do at the moment.
How many hours do you have?
No.
Okay. So we're talking about, we're talking about Pedal for Hope and Pedal On program. So during my first breast cancer journey, I got a bit of physio, and that was it. I was 26, you know, I was strong. I started going to the gym, and that was it. Second diagnosis was really shocking because I was actually really fit, mm-hmm. looked healthy. I was already a mom to three. And so before that, I came to New Zealand, and I didn't know anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I lived in Takapuna at the Sentinel, 26th floor. Manu at the time was paddleboarding. Everyone was it was a real hit. You know, it just started kind of becoming a trend. And I looked away. I looked at the water every Tuesday. I used to go to the beach series. Mm. And I was like, what are they doing? What is this sport? You know, and I like challenges. I like trying new things. And I've learned that I'm pretty competitive as well, which is something that I didn't say about myself many, many years ago. But I learned that I do like a bit of competition. And so I watched it. And then we traveled to Waiheke. I got on a board for the first time. Mm. Never, ever got off the board. Mm. This became my waka. This became my vehicle for self-confidence. This became my vehicle to learn more about our bodies and functionality. And so what I noticed was that I'm becoming more self-confident on the water, because I wasn't an ocean girl, you know. I am getting vitamin D from the sun. I am smiling and I can go for miles, and I'm using every single muscle in my body. Mm. My core started getting stronger, my balance, everything. And so I said, my range movement is improved. Like, something's good about this sport. And so I got out of the water one day. Victoria Stewart, who's sister from another mother here, she was racing with me. And I said to her, what about a breast cancer event on the water, like a race? And she said, oh my God, that's such a good idea. And I thought, the only way I can actually communicate with people and meet new people is through my story, right? We tell our story, we meet new people. And so back then I was volunteering for the Breast Cancer Foundation and brought back the Pink Ribbon Breakfast and all of that. And so I started meeting a little bit of people around the arena. So she said, oh my God, that's a great idea. And I think in a couple of weeks we had like this huge committee.
Yeah.
And we started the Pedal for Hope, which became the most iconic big fundraiser on the water event Auckland has ever seen, or mm-hmm. New Zealand. It grew a lot. We started fundraising. Maybe we raised about 20, 30 grand, and we pushed it up to 80, and we got to about 120K just from racing, doing relay races and getting all the community involved. And it was a trend, you know, when we did it from 2011 to about 2017, 18. Mm-hmm. We did one in Wellington. I also traveled to Israel and fundraised twice on the water there. So connected with all the water people. And water people are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a whole new world that opened to me. And so through that, we started fundraising for the Breast Cancer Foundation. And then at some point, Van, who is a really good friend of mine, she was the CEO, said, look, you guys have got to take it to the next level. You've got to find something that you can do with the money, because we were fundraising for different programs that had to do with cancer rehabilitation. Now, the main reason for it is that people don't know. There's no ACC in New Zealand for cancer,
mm-hmm.
you know. There's no support. There's no financial support. There's no cushioning. You break a finger, you go to the physio, you go and get, I don't know, acupuncture. You get all some money to just sit at home and heal that little finger. But when you get cancer, you don't.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I realized there's no funding from the government for rehabilitation after cancer diagnosis. And so we decided to build a program. We were introduced to Pink and Steel Rehabilitation Foundation, to Lou James. We sat down, we started writing a program. I was the guinea pig. I fell into like papuki multiple times, got an infection, I think, at some point. We had to learn how to do rescue drills. And I literally got a certificate as a paddleboarding instructor. There is something like this. And we started the paddle-on program. We got physios on board, trained them to become instructors on the water. Yeah. And I remember walking into the Breast Cancer Foundation offices and we sat down for this meeting. And I remember the team looking at us going, "You want to take cancer patients on the water, on New Zealand ocean, not even a swimming pool?" Yeah. Like, and I said, "Yes." The amount of confidence, we did a research and you saw the results that came out, confidence, self-love, community aspect. It's all about building communities, sharing stories. And then you've got the physical aspect, which is core strength, overall strength, stamina. You know, you fall in the water, what do you do? You know, so you know how to save yourself. And range of movement. All these amazing things came out of it and we're still going. So the fundraising, for me at some point, doing it as the Pedal for Hope and racing was a bit of an issue because I was going through a lot of surgeries. So I couldn't actually race. And my last race before I had a very big infection on my right breast. And I remember racing 3 days before I knew my breast was going to come off. Again, like for the, I don't know what time. And someone said, "Are you crazy? Like you're," I said, "Well, anyway, it's going next week." So I just, and during my race, I had no, it was leaking. There was a lot of issues with that breast. There's nothing was going on. It was like my mindset, my whole body was in this mode. And I was racing and there was no drops coming out. It was because I had an incision didn't close. And the amount of confidence, smiles on my face was just like, you know, infinite, right? So physios have been coaching cancer patients and the paddle-on. We decided at some point it's not going to be just for breast cancer patients or survivors. It's going to be, we call it sufferers. It's going to be for every cancer sufferer. It opened up the door to a lot of people who have never even swam in the ocean. It opened up the door to physios who suddenly could do something else. And I was part of training some physios from Australia. It's probably one of the most significant part of my life story. Whenever I talk about it, I get a chill because who would have thought that this girl came from Israel to Australia, who's, you know, get on the water, become an instructor and create such thing with an incredible community. Okay. Yeah. It's not a one person's job. There were a lot of people that have been involved in it, but leading the way and talking about it, of course, became my thing. And I'm so grateful for this journey and seeing people's faces, pedaling with them, hearing their stories. And they go, "Oh, so you had breast cancer." You know, there's all these women on the water going, I usually join at the end of the 8 sessions. Yeah. And they go, "Isn't this fantastic, this program?" And I usually go, "Yeah. So what is your story?" Like, and I go, "I'm one of the people that got you here." And I think it inspired so many people.
Yep.
So the Pedal for Hope was a vehicle. And in the last 3-4 years, we've been doing Eat, Drink, Pink. So I joined hands with Revitalash New Zealand. They took that event on board as a presenting sponsor. We've been raising, last year was $35,000. It all goes to cancer rehabilitation that is not funded by the government. And I'll repeat that. And I really want to march, you should join me as well, is to get some sort of equivalent to ACC program in New Zealand for cancer sufferers, because I think it's really necessary. There's so many side effects to cancer. You might not even be relieved from these side effects for the rest of your life. There's fatigue, there's, you know, physical aspects to it and mental, because it's trauma. And how can people fund it when they need to also not just survive it, but thrive after it and rebuild themselves, you know, and their families?
Yeah, it is so true. And Corinne, thank you for sharing that. I can see through anyone that's watching how you glow through explaining the foundation and everything you're doing. It's amazing to see, and I can feel that. And it's just awesome. And that's why, you know, from what I've seen the last few years, and why I wanted to come for you to come on the show to talk to you about the story, and so people can hear it and what you've gone through, and to say, look, you know, it's okay. It's okay.
You're not alone in this, you know? And I think more so, I've taken it, I talk about from adversity to creativity. Yeah. And sometimes we can't see the light. We're in the dark. You know, I coach people. Mm-hmm. I have been helping people. And also I'm upskilling all the time. I'm going to do another couple of coaching courses as well. And I guess that when, you know, you get diagnosed or something happens to you, you find it really hard to see the light, you know, and I get it. But sometimes just from a little beacon, just a tiny one, if you find something that you're passionate about and you just say it, people will come, you know. You can create the most incredible things. I'm not going to lie and say that I'm so glad I got breast cancer twice. Yeah. No. But I'm going to say that I'm really grateful for the journey. And I'm really grateful for the things I've created, and now, you know, podcasts and a book. Who would think, you know? So at the end of the day, there is hope. You know, there is hope. And I know that a lot of people can argue that when they get, you know, terminal cancer, and we've got to say this, you know, it's terminal. What do I do? But everything in life is temporary, the good and the bad. And so with every diagnosis, we've got to find that light, you know, those moments, and really appreciate them for what they are, and appreciate the people around us and what we can create to leave something behind. For me, it was always about, what can I leave behind for my children? What can I teach them throughout this journey? What can I give to the community that really, really helped me? I don't think I would have been here without... another moment, without the amazing people
that
stood by my children and by me, you know?
Yeah. Look, I think that's an amazing and powerful moment for us to end off today. I know, Corinne, you like myself, we can talk for hours.
I know.
I've got a busy day today. I'm being crazy enough. I'm doing five podcasts in five factors sessions. So we're going to end off today. I know that there's so much more to what you have to offer us. I know there's so much more behind there. There's your book. There's everything else. But I want to leave a little bit on the table. I sometimes like that. So if people listen to this, go, holy shit, she's amazing. I want to know more. They go and find new stuff and more stuff about you.
Yeah.
The only question I have before we end off today is, where can our audience find you?
So I'm probably quite big on Instagram. Mm. So I found my voice there, and it's great. It's a really great platform to share knowledge and content. So Instagram is Corinne Horan. Mm. I think it's Corinne_Horan. My website is live, and I launched it last year, the end of last year. Thank you, Alex. He's done a great job.
Yep, looks very nice.
So that's CorinneHoran.com. So people can actually email me through it and invite me for their public speaking gigs. And you can email me, CorinneHoranNZ@gmail.com. I always try to, you know, take the time to reply to people. And I guess that I'm not going to give my phone number, but you can find it probably online, because I'm a public figure.
Yeah.
And I believe that if I'm a public figure, then I've got a role to play, right? So
true.
I'm reachable, you know, I'm accessible, and I'm always here to help however and whenever I can.
Thanks so much, Corinne, for that. And as always, the details will be in the description on, depending if you're watching or listening at the moment. And as always, thank you so much for the opportunity to come share your story. It's an amazing to hear and amazing to see what you're doing across in the community and so forth. And, you know, to everyone else that's come over to the Wolf Country podcast for today's episode, as I say always at the end of the episode, is I don't care about your shares. I don't care about your likes. Saying, hey, follow. What I care about is taking something from today's message that is important to you. Or if you think there's something important for someone else that needs it, we all need to help each other. We all need to show each other it's the right way. I don't care about us all becoming famous together. That's not what is important. Important is working together and saying it is okay. We all can get through this together. But thanks for coming over to the show. And as always, hope to see you again.